really know what total disgrace feels like. I'll wager that it's so far from near total disgrace as to be incomprehensible for a while. The difference, say, between a toothache and being burned alive. I think of that man in the airplane bathroom. The flight attendant knocks, thinking he has his trousers off and is trying to rinse them in that worthless little sink. But he's still fully dressed and looking in the mirror, shocked that he could feel so fundamentally different, yet still have human features, let alone the same face, the two eyes right where they were the last time he checked, that same nose and mouth. But how can this be? He wonders. Sir, the woman on the other side of the door says, sir, you have to come out now. Sir, are you all right? When it's my turn, I'll open my mouth, unable to speak, and feel a little tap on my wrist. Time to stand up, my watch will whisper. Then, before killing myself, I'll say one last time, I am standing up. Thank you. The Spirit World. Our house on Emerald Isle is divided down the middle and has an E beside one front door and a W beside the other. The east side is ruled by Hugh, and the bedroom we share is on the top floor. It opens onto a deck that overlooks the ocean and is next to Amy's room, which is the same size as ours, but is shaped differently. Unlike Lisa and Paul, who were on the west side of the house and could probably sleep on burlap without noticing it, Amy likes nice sheets. She'd packed a new set in her suitcase, and on the night before Thanksgiving, as I helped her make her bed, she mentioned a friend who'd come to her apartment for dinner the previous evening in New York. He drinks Coke, right? So I went to the store on the corner to buy some, she said. And you know how those new bottles have names on the labels, Blake or Kelly or whatever? I nodded. Well, there were only two left on the shelf, one with Mom printed on it, and the other with Tiffany. I reached for a pillowcase. Do you think if I were dead, there would have been three bottles on the shelf instead of two, and the third would have had my name on it? Amy thought for a moment. Yes. So the only Cokes at that store in New York City are for people in our family who have died? She smoothed out the bedspread. Yes. I couldn't tell if she honestly believed this. It's hard to say with Amy. On the one hand, she's very pragmatic, and on the other, she's open to just about anything. Astrology, for instance. I wouldn't call her a nut, exactly, but she has paid good money to have her chart done, and if you're talking about someone, she'll often ask when this person's birthday is, and then say something like, ah, a Gemini, okay, that makes sense now. She's big on acupuncture as well, which I also tend to think is dubious, at least for things like allergies. That said, I admire people who are curious and open their minds to new possibilities, especially after a certain age. You have to draw the line somewhere, though, and with me, it's my anus. When I was in my early 30s, it became a thing to have colonics. A number of my friends started going to a man in Chicago and discussing the rubble he'd discovered in their lower intestines. A pumpkin seed, and I haven't eaten pumpkin in 8 years. Their insides were like Pharaoh's tombs, dark catacombs littered with ancient relics. Now people are giving themselves coffee enemas, believing it wards off and even cures cancer. I think I'll take the cancer, thank you, my sister Lisa said to me on Thanksgiving morning. Amen to that, I agreed. Lisa's not open to the things that Paul and Amy are, but she has her equivalents. If you told her, for instance, that she was holding her car keys the wrong way, and that there were meetings for people like her, she'd likely attend them for at least 3 months. One of the groups she was going to lately was for mindful eating. It's not about dieting. We don't believe in that, she said. You're supposed to carry on as usual, 3 meals a day plus snacks and desserts or whatever. The difference is that now you think about it. She then confessed that the donut she had just finished had been her 6th of the day. "Who brought these?" she asked. I looked at the box and whimpered a little. "Kathy, I think." "God damn her," Lisa whispered. A few weeks before we came to the beach, Amy paid a great deal of money to visit a well-known psychic. The woman has a long waiting list, but someone pulled a few strings, and not long after getting the idea, Amy had her session, which took place over the phone and lasted for an hour. She sent me a brief email after it was over and went into greater detail as we rode with Gretchen from the Raleigh airport to Emerald Isle the day before Thanksgiving. "So start again from the top," I said. "Was it scary?" "It was maybe like calling someone in prison and having one person after another get on the line," she said from the back seat. "First, I talked to Mom for a while, who's doing well, by the way, and takes credit for setting up you and Hugh. Then Tiffany appeared." I ripped open a bag of almonds. "Yeah, right." "Ordinarily, I'd be like that too," Amy said, "but the psychic's voice changed after Mom went away. She sounded tough all of a sudden and started by saying, 'I really don't feel like talking to you right now. This is a favor, okay?'" Tiffany thanked Amy for cleaning up the mess she'd left after she committed suicide. "That's strange," I said. "I mean, how would the psychic have known anything about that?" Amy sat up and moved closer so that her head was between my seat and Gretchen's. "I know. She said that Tiffany had tried to kill herself before, also true, and that she always knew she was going to do this. The only question was when. It was crazy how much she got right." "Your sister was mentally ill," she said, "possibly bipolar, and stopped taking her medication because she didn't want to dull herself. She said Tiffany felt like everyone was taking from her, using her." "That was certainly true," I said. "Most of what Tiffany had to say was directed at you," Amy told me. "She wants you to know that the two of you are okay now and that she's not mad anymore." "She's not mad," I said. "Her. I'm the one who had reason to be mad. She said she'd misunderstood you and that lately she's been working on herself." "You have to work on yourself after you're dead?" I asked. It seemed a bit much, like having to continue a diet or your participation in AA. I thought that death let you off the hook when it came to certain things, that it somehow purified you. "Tiffany's been hanging out a lot with Mom's dad, Grandpa Leonard," Amy told me. This made me furious for some reason. "But she didn't even know him. I guess they met there," Amy said. "And where is that?" Amy shrugged. "I don't know. It's not like you can ask 1,000 questions and get them answered. They tell you what they want to tell you, and you just listen." I tried to let that sink in. "She and Mom are finally getting along," Amy continued. "She mainly wanted to let you know that she has no hard feelings. The psychic said Tiffany's been trying to tell you this herself and asked if you've had a lot of problems with your phone lately." "No." "Power outages?" Again, I said no. "What about butterflies?" "Are you serious?" I asked. "Our house last winter was loaded with them. I've never seen anything like it. In the summer, fine, but this was crazy. Hugh and I talked about it every day." Amy crossed her arms. "It was Tiffany. She was trying to contact you." The appointment with the psychic had unnerved the whole family. Tiffany was calmer than normal, but still it was like an actual conversation with her, Amy said. You remember how those were, right? We'd be shaking while they were going on. Then we'd think about them for weeks afterward. I remember, Gretchen and I said at the same time. After Tiffany signed off, Amy spoke to an actor she'd known who died of a heroin overdose a few years back, and then to her first serious boyfriend, John Chocontes, who had a brain aneurysm when he was 25. Because she'd had a session so recently, I was welcome to cut to the front of the line and have one of my own the following week. "Do you want me to give you the psychic's number?" I said nothing. "Is that a no?" Amy asked. Often, when signing books, I will pretend to have powers. Well, look at the Scorpio, I'll say, when someone approaches my table. I'm just guessing. I wouldn't know a Scorpio from a double Sagittarius. The key I learned is to speak with authority. It's never, are you a Libra? But rather, it's about time I had a Libra up in here. Every now and then, I'll be right, and the person will be shocked. How did you know my sign? They'll ask. The same way I know you have a sister. If I'm right about the sister as well, the person I'm talking to will become like a cat released into a new setting, very low to the ground and suspicious. Who are you talking to? Did one of my friends put you up to this? I met a young woman a few years back, and after being right about both her sign and her sister, I said, as if I were trying to recall something I had dreamed, you were in a hospital earlier this week, not for yourself, but for someone else. You were visiting someone very close to you. The woman fell apart before my eyes. My mother has cancer. They operated, but how do you... What are you doing? I can't help it, I told her. I know things. I see them. I don't, of course. Those were just guesses pulled out of my ass in order to get a rise out of someone. Hugh said the psychic Amy went to did the same thing, but I'm not sure. How would she know what Tiffany sounded like? Looked her up on YouTube, he said. Read one of your stories. These people tell you what you want to hear. It's their way of getting you to come back. There's something about picking the psychic apart that I don't like. It's cynical and uninteresting. That said, I knew I didn't want to book a session. My mother and I were very close, and though I miss her terribly, I'm not sure I need to talk to her again. Since her death, I thought of it as an impossibility. Now it felt like a decision, like Mom wants to speak to me, and I'm saying no. But what if she's angry at me for some reason? What would I do with that? As for Tiffany, a few months after she died, a Dutch film crew came to Sussex and followed me around for 3 days. Our conversation was all over the place. We talked about England, writing, life with Hugh. The last hour was shot on a hilltop overlooking my house. The interviewer, a man named Vim, sat beside me. Off camera, he'd mentioned that my sister had recently taken her life. Now he brought it up again. What if you could ask her one question? It seemed like such a television moment, the intimacy unearned, grotesque almost. And so I paused and blinked hard. Then I said, I'd ask, can I have back that money I loaned you? What troubled me most about Amy's talk with the psychic was the notion that the dead are unsettled, that they linger. I said to Lisa at the beach that Thanksgiving, if they can see us from wherever they are, what's to stop them from watching us on the toilet? Lisa took a moment to consider this. I'm guessing that certain places are just off limits. And who would make them off limits? I asked. I don't know, she said. God, maybe? I mean, beats me. We were returning from a walk and came upon our father in the middle of the street, a quarter mile from the house. He was dressed in jeans and had a flat-topped cap on his head. His flannel shirt was untucked, and the tail of it drooped from beneath the hem of his windbreaker. What are you doing here? I asked. Looking for someone, he said. Lisa asked, too, and he said he didn't know. I was just hoping somebody might come along and invite me to his house to watch the game. The Panthers are playing this afternoon, and you don't have a goddamn TV. You thought someone was just going to say, hey, why don't you come to my place and watch some football? Lisa asked. I was going to build up to it, my father said. You know, drop hints and so forth. The day after Thanksgiving was bright and unseasonably warm. Hugh made ham sandwiches for lunch, and we ate on the deck. We need to have a code word, so when the next one of us dies, we'll know if the psychic is for real, Amy said. She turned to Dad, the most likely candidate for ceasing to live. What'll yours be? He gave it no thought. Ecstasy. Like the drug? I asked. He picked up his sandwich. What drug? It should be something you say a lot, I told him. Something that would let us know it's really you. Maybe you've gained weight. Or Obama's from Kenya. Those are both three words, Lisa noted. What about Broderson, I said, referring to a North Carolina painter whose work my father collected in the 1970s. Oh, that's perfect, Amy said. I went into the kitchen to get another napkin, and by the time I returned, the topic had changed, and Dad was discussing someone who goes to his gym. The guy is in his 40s and apparently stands too close in the locker room. He undresses me with his eyes, and it makes me uncomfortable, my father said. How does someone undress you with his eyes when you're already undressed? I asked. By that point, what's he looking at? Your soul? On our final evening at the beach over the Thanksgiving weekend, Amy and my niece Madeline usually host a spa night. They dress in uniforms and let it be known beforehand that clients are expected to tip, and generously. Facials are given, and Kathy offers foot massages. The treatments feel great, but the best part is listening to Amy, who plays the role of the supervisor. This year, while massaging clay into my father's face, she asked him if he was alone this evening or with his gay lover. I know that a lot of men, such as yourself, also like their testicles waxed, Amy said. If that is of any interest to you, sir, I can get my trainee, Madeline, right on it. Maddie, you up for this? It's so subversive, not just insisting that our father is gay, but that his 12-year-old granddaughter might want to rip the hair off his balls. Before the clay is rubbed into our faces, we're outfitted in shower caps, and afterward, while it dries, we lie back with cucumber slices on our eyes. Paul programs his iPad to play spa music or what passes for music in such places, the sound of a waterfall or rustling leaves, a whale saying something nice to another whale, a harp. This year, I lifted the cucumbers off my eyes and saw Lisa and Dad stretched out like corpses, fast asleep. Paul was out as well, and Gretchen, whose legs were shin deep in the warm, whirling bath, was getting there. It seems there was a perfectly good explanation for all the butterflies in our Sussex house the previous winter. From what I'd read since Amy brought it up, they flew in through our windows in early autumn, then passed into a kind of hibernation. Hugh and I were away until right before Christmas, and when we returned and cranked up the heat, the butterflies, mainly tortoise shells, dozens and dozens of them, awoke, wrongly believing that spring had arrived. They were on all the second-floor windows, batting against the panes, desperate to get out. As symbols go, they're a bit too sweet. Right for Lisa, but all wrong for Tiffany, who'd have been better represented by something more dynamic. Crows, maybe. Two big ones flew down the chimney of my office that winter and tore the place apart, systematically overturning and then shitting on everything I cared about. What, I wondered, placing the cucumbers back over my eyes, would my symbol be? The last time I saw my sister Tiffany was at the stage door at Symphony Hall in Boston. I'd just finished a show and was getting ready to sign books when I heard her say, "David! David! It's me!" We hadn't spoken in 4 years at that point, and I was shocked by her appearance. Tiffany always looked like my mother when she was young. Now she looked like my mother when she was old, though at the time she couldn't have been more than 45. "It's me! Tiffany!" She held up a paper bag with the Starbucks logo on it. Her shoes looked like she'd found them in a trash can. "I have something for you." There was a security guard holding the stage door open, and I said to him, "Will you close that, please?" I had filled the house that night. I was in charge, Mr. Sedaris. "The door," I repeated. "I'd like for you to close it now." And so the man did. He shut the door in my sister's face, and I never saw her or spoke to her again. not when she was evicted from her apartment, not when she was raped, not when she was hospitalized after her first suicide attempt. She was, I told myself, someone else's problem. I couldn't deal with her anymore. Well, the rest of my family said, it was Tiffany. Don't be too hard on yourself. We all know how she can be. Perhaps like the psychic, they were just telling me what I needed to hear, something to ease my conscience and make me feel that underneath it all, I'm no different from anyone else. They've always done that for me, my family. It's what keeps me coming back. And while you're up there, check on my prostate. The summer after I turned 16, I took driver's ed from a coach at my high school and quickly realized that this was not for me. Turning invoked a great deal of anxiety, as did staying in my lane and parking. Oh, parking. That was the worst. I suppose I could have tried harder to overcome my fear and discomfort, but I didn't. And as a result, I have never gotten a ticket, made a car payment, or called anyone a fucking piece of shit asshole through an open or closed driver's side window. It's not that I never get angry, just that I never get angry the way people behind a wheel do. My fury isn't poetry, just greeting card prose. Go to hell, you. What do you say when someone cuts you off in traffic? I asked a woman in Copenhagen whose book I was signing. We're not big on cursing, she told me, so the worst we're likely to come out with, and it's pretty common, is why don't you run around in my ass? There are asses in America where that might not be much of a threat. This is to say that though it would be dark in there and it probably wouldn't smell so great, at least you'd have some room to spread out. It would be more like a prison cell than, say, a coffin. I'd asked the same question a few years earlier in Amsterdam and learned that in the Netherlands you're more apt to bring a disease into it. Like, if someone drives in a crazy way, it is normal to call them a cholera sufferer, a Dutch woman told me. Either that or a cancer whore. I'd never thought of stitching those two particular words together. A cancer whore, I asked. She nodded. I'm pretty sure it comes from The Hague. The following day, I checked out her story with a woman named Els, who said, oh, sure, cancer whore. I hear it all the time. You can also say cancer slut. She added that the words were pretty much the same in Dutch as they are in English. We say slet, she said, kanker slet. Would you ever call someone a diabetes slet, I asked. She looked at me as if I were missing out on something so fundamental. It was a wonder I could dress myself in the morning. Of course not, she said. The disease has to be terminal. So, like, AIDS whore? Again, she seemed exasperated. AIDS? Never. Those poor people, that's not funny. If you want to be creative, you say something like dirty typhus mongoloid, which you hear a lot lately. She paused. Is that the right word, mongoloid? We would say person with Down syndrome, I told her. But I guess that when joined with the words dirty and typhus, it would be too long. Especially when you're passing someone on the highway. They're strange, the Dutch. After talking to Els, I met a man who frequently calls his 18-month-old daughter a little ball sack. Because, I mean, it's what you do, he explained. What do you mean it's what you do, I said. It's not what I do or anyone in my family does. I don't even call my ball sack a ball sack. He shrugged, Dutchily. In Vienna, I returned to my original question. What do Austrians yell out their car windows when they get angry? Well, a young woman told me, sometimes we will say, why don't you find a spot on my ass that you would like to lick and lick it? I'm guessing this is quicker to say and less awkward sounding in German. Even so, it lacks a certain something. You give them a choice of where to lick your ass, I asked. That doesn't sound like much of a threat, given that they could pick a spot on the side or up top where it's basically just your lower back. She agreed. And sometimes, if the bad driver is a female, we will call her a blood sausage. Is that because a woman has a period? I asked. Maybe. Later that night, I met a Bulgarian. In my country, you say to someone you hate, may you build a house from your kidney stones. Well, finally, I thought. This is essentially wishing someone an eternity of gut-wrenching pain, all for taking the parking space you wanted or not turning his blinker on. I've had 3 kidney stones in my life, each the size of a small piece of gravel you might find at the bottom of an aquarium, and each excruciating. The thought of passing enough of them to build an entire house, even if it was just big enough for a termite to live in, is unfathomable. Those Bulgarians don't fool around, though no one can come close to the Romanians. At a book signing in Boston, I met a woman from Bucharest. My publicist is Romanian, I told her. Not full-blooded, like you, but still, she can speak a little. Her favorite saying, taught to her by her grandmother, is, I shit in your mother's mouth, she asked. That's probably what it was. It's a very popular curse. The woman walked away, and I thought, well, I can see why. I shit in your mother's mouth. Does it get any nastier than that? I discovered a year later, on my first trip to Bucharest, that actually, yes, it does. What's the absolute worst thing you've ever heard? I asked from the stage at the end of my reading. People lined up with answers. And I learned that, as in all Catholic and Eastern Orthodox countries, the most popular target when on the attack is the other person's mother. Thus, I fuck your mother's dead. I fuck your mother's Christ. I fuck your mother's icon. I fuck your mother's Easter. I fuck your mother's onion. I will make skis out of your mother's cross. And I fuck your mother's memorial cake. This is something you bake when a loved one dies. And there's a lot of cursing centered around it. The absolute worst being, I dragged my balls across your mother's memorial cake. From cherry to cherry. and to each of the candles. A young woman told me this, and when I repeated it to the fellow who drove me to the airport the following morning and who had previously been chatty, he fell silent. That is total devastation, he eventually said. I mean, wow. What kind of a person told you this? Was it a girl? Was she pretty? The Romanians really do lead the world when it comes to cursing. What have you got for me? I asked a woman from Transylvania who was now living in Vienna. Shove your hand up my ass and jerk off my shit, she offered. I was stunned. Anyone else would say, shove your hand up my ass, and then run out of imagination, I told her. You people, though, you just keep going. And that's what makes you the champions you are. Maybe it's not too late to learn how to drive, I thought. Watching as she walked out the door and onto the unsuspecting streets of Vienna, this poet, this queen, this glittering jewel in a city of flint.
The Comey Memo. It was mid-August on Emerald Isle, and so far no one had drowned or been attacked by sharks. This was good news for the local realtors, one of whom, a cheerful woman named Phyllis, had become a family friend. Hugh dropped by to see her the day after we arrived and returned an hour or so later with a flushed face. Guess who's staying 12 houses down? James Comey, that's who. He came into the office earlier this week and had his picture taken with Sherry. I went out to the deck where Gretchen was hanging up her wet swimsuit. You'll never believe who's staying 8 houses away. Jim Comey. She pulled a clothespin out of her mouth. Wow, you're kidding. Next, I told my niece Madeline, who is 14. She looked up dully from her phone and said, who? The woman behind the counter at the post office responded the same way. You know, I told her, the guy who's been all over the news lately. Oh my God, she said. How long has he been here? I had no idea, but didn't want to sound like I was out of the loop. 5 days, and he's only a few houses away from me. I could practically hear the phone being dialed as I left. Guess who's on the 7400 block of Ocean Drive? You what? Hugh said when I told him I'd told the postmistress. Now everyone will know. I wrote my friend Lynette and was about to write our neighbor Lee when I found Hugh writing him. It's my news, not yours, he hissed. Late that afternoon, we rented a golf cart. The girls took it out just before sunset and turned around in James Comey's driveway. At least I think it was his, my sister-in-law Kathy reported at dinner that night. There was a black SUV with Virginia plates and dark windows parked out front. After eating, we all jumped into the golf cart and drove by the house twice. Look, lights are on. Rental units turned over at noon the following day, so we never got a chance to see him, this former director of the FBI, whom we all hated, until someone we hated even more fired him. Oh well, Amy said. It was fun to be excited for a while. Now we can all go back to doing nothing. Aside from Jim Comey, the big topic that week was our father, who was supposed to join us but had to cancel when his ride fell through. He'd lost his license earlier in the summer, and we'd all drawn a collective sigh of relief. Now we learned that he'd returned to the DMV with a letter from his eye doctor and gotten it back. I followed him home from a dental appointment last week and couldn't believe it, Kathy said late one evening, lighting a cigarette on the deck that overlooks the ocean. He has double vision and was all over the road. It's a miracle he didn't hit someone. My father lives on his Social Security. He won't touch his savings or investments, which are substantial, as he wants to leave as much as possible to his children. It's what kept him alive during the Obama years, the hope that whoever succeeded him would eliminate the estate tax. It would be the perfect irony, then, for him to get into an accident and lose everything in a lawsuit. Lisa's fear is that he'll kill a child. None of the rest of us have gotten that specific, though I suppose she has a point. Killing a toddler sounds a lot worse than killing a fellow 94-year-old. I'm getting regular calls from the neighbors now, Amy told me. So are Paul and Lisa. Y'all need to be doing more for your father, they say. He's too old to be living in that big house all on his own. I thought of the last time I'd visited him, 2 years earlier. Hugh and I were driving from Emerald Isle to the Raleigh airport and thought we'd drop in before flying back to England. I phoned again and again to say we were coming and left any number of messages. He hadn't responded, though, and because of his age, I started to wonder if maybe he was dead. On the 3-hour ride to the house, I considered how probable this actually was. "Why don't you go in first?" I said to Hugh when we got to the house. "Hello?" he called, sticking his head in the door. I stood behind him and looked through the window to see my father scuttling around the corner. "Hey now, this is a surprise." I followed Hugh into the kitchen. "I left 5 or 6 messages," I said, relieved by how relieved I felt. I'm guessing he'd set his air conditioner on 98, 2 degrees cooler than it was outside, which I didn't even know was possible. The heat and stillness made everything I saw look worse. My father's stove stopped working years ago, so he used his microwave to boil water and make us cups of instant coffee. We stood by the refrigerator, sweating. Then he asked if Hugh would advise him on a painting he had. "It's just here, around the corner," he said, grabbing a flashlight and stepping into what used to be a hallway, but now had a chair and a table loaded with papers in it. "Is the overhead light out?" I asked. "Want me to change it?" "No, it's fine," my father said. "So you use the flashlight to save electricity," he explained. We saw the painting my father was referring to the way a burglar might, the beam roving from spot to spot before sliding to the floor. "If he won't move, why won't he at least get a housekeeper to come in once a week?" Hugh asked after we'd left and were on our way to the airport, me so depressed I was finding it hard to breathe. "Better yet, he could hire someone to live with him." "That person might rip him off," I whispered. "Why are you whispering?" Hugh asked. "So the people in the next car won't know there's a broken stove at my father's house they can steal." Even if conditions hadn't grown worse over the past 2 years, my father would need to make some sort of change. "What I can't understand," I said to Amy on the beach one afternoon, "is not wanting to move. Who wouldn't prefer a new environment, a clean slate? He can afford to keep his house exactly as it is, could pay someone to drive him over every day and wait outside while he stacks up junk mail." "You're trying to convince me?" Amy asked. "The one who has a second apartment 2 blocks from her first apartment just so she can get away from her rabbit for a couple hours a day?" According to Kathy, Lisa took my father to look at 2 different retirement communities not far from his house in Raleigh. "Not nursing homes," my sister assured him. "There are people as young as 65 living here." "Your dad said he liked the first place, but when an apartment opened up, he claimed he couldn't possibly move until he fixes up the house he's living in." "He's been saying that for 50 years, I told her. Amy reached for her water bottle. "Dad refuses to move, and when I tell his neighbors that, they say, 'Well, then you need to make him.' They're all thinking we don't care, but how do you make Dad do something?" "Part of the problem," I explained to Hugh, who was stretched out beside me with a floppy hat over his face, "is that our father hates old people. Always has. If everyone else in the retirement home was 20, he'd be a lot more likely to give it a try, especially if they were all girls, and all they were allowed to wear were bikini bottoms. I rubbed some sunblock into my reddening forehead. I can't believe we missed James Comey. 2 days later, Amy, Hugh, and I headed to Raleigh, the plan being to drop by my dad's place before continuing on to the airport. At a Starbucks a few miles from his house, we picked up 4 cups of coffee. I was holding one for myself and another for my father when we walked through his front door. "We're here!" He wasn't in the kitchen, so after pausing to note the pair of briefs balled up and lying on my mother's beloved butcher block table, we moved down the hall and looked into bedrooms I hadn't seen in years. Each was in the same state. His first step is to move in a table he can use as a desk. This will eventually be piled so high with papers that the stacks will topple onto the floor, or, likelier still, into boxes that sit on the floor and have even more papers in them. The beds will have towering stacks upon them as well, and the various mounds will continue to grow until he crowds himself out and moves on to the next bedroom. There are 5 of them, including his own, which is at the end of the hall. "Dad?" 10 years earlier, my father, Amy, and I attended a wedding in Florida and stayed at a hotel in Delray Beach. "How did you sleep?" I asked over breakfast the next morning. He thought for a moment. "I slept like a doll." Perhaps he meant I slept like a baby and it came out wrong, but ever since, it's what everyone in my family says. "I slept like a doll." My father so loved his bed at the hotel that Amy and I bought him one, explaining that what made it nice wasn't just the mattress, but the sheets, which were high quality and, more important still, clean. The bed my father slept on in Florida would have vomited its stuffing had it seen its filthy twin in North Carolina. There was a narrow space for a person to lie on, but the rest of it, like the rest of the room itself, was piled high with bank statements, along with catalogs and belts and pages torn from newspapers. It was hard to pick out any one thing. Rather, it blurred into a continuous mass, sort of like a glacier. Overlooking it all, balanced atop a stack of 20-year-old golf magazines on his high boy were a half dozen photos of the family taken on Emerald Isle in 1981 and arranged under glass in a single frame. In them, Lisa looks amazing. All us kids do. It was that moment in a family's life when everything is golden. Literally, our tans were phenomenal, but so was our outlook. Ranging in age from 12 to 24, my brother, sisters, and I gazed into the future and saw only promise. It's not like we don't see it now. We're not pessimists, exactly. But in late middle age, when you envision your life 10 years down the line, you're more likely to see a bedpan than a Tony Award. That our younger, cuter, infinitely more hopeful selves oversaw such total chaos made it all the sadder. I was just wondering what the house would look like had my mother been the surviving parent when I noticed my father on the deck just off his bedroom, staring into a tree. I'd last seen him a month earlier and had noticed how hunched over he was, not bent into the shape of a question mark the way some people his age are, but still it made him look frailer. "Hey," he said as I opened the sliding glass door. "There you are." He wore white tennis shorts with a beige T-shirt and matching socks. Everything looked too big on him, his watch, his glasses, even his teeth, which is odd as they're completely his own. When he stepped forward to hug me, I noticed 4 mean-looking bruises on his arm. They weren't purple but black and had cotton balls over them, held down with masking tape. "We brought you a cup of coffee," I said. "Fantastic." The living room was the last semi-presentable patch of territory in my father's house, the only one without a desk in it, so we retired there. "Gosh, you all look terrific," he said, taking a seat on the sofa. "So tanned and healthy." "What happened to your arm?" I asked. "I fell," he told me, waving away my concern. "It happens sometimes when I turn around too quickly." "So you fall, and then what?" I crawl around for a while until I come to a chair or something, and then I lift myself up. Hey, he said to Amy, no doubt eager to change the subject. I pulled out a few things I thought you might like. He gestured to a pile on a low table beside the sofa. There's a straw hat that belonged to your mother and some pocketbooks. I don't really wear hats, Amy told him. I didn't want my father to feel bad, so I picked it up. The only bit that really says woman is the bow, I said, walking into the bathroom to try it on and noticing that both the sinks were filled with stuffed animals. It was like they had planned to take a bath and were just waiting for someone to turn the water on. What on earth, I thought. I can't believe that the straw is still in such good shape, I called into the other room. Isn't it? My father called back. I've got a little something for you, too, he said as I reclaimed my seat, the hat still on my head. Just a few things I knew you'd like. On top of my pile were two Bruegel postcards. Both were in inexpensive plastic frames, bought that way, I assumed. He's someone you like, right? Yes, I said. Thank you so much. Beneath the postcards were a couple of nature calendars, the first of which had a fox on the cover, nuzzling her kit. Isn't that terrific? I thought maybe you'd want to frame it. Hmm, I said. My father has criticized every gift I've ever given him. His disapproval is consistently swift and hard, but for some reason I can never respond in kind. How nice, I told him. The second calendar was devoted to chimps. I know how much you like them. And these photos, I'm telling you, they're just outstanding. I opened it to March and saw an adult male with his arms crossed, not defiantly, but as if he were trying to make up his mind about something, whether to rip off the photographer's hands or start with his face, most likely. Then I noticed that the calendar was 2 years old. Well, I announced, looking at my watch, I guess we'd better get going. Amy and I were too shaken up to say much of anything in the car, underpants on Mom's butcher block table. So we just looked out the windows until we reached the airport. There we learned there was weather in Washington, D.C., where Hugh and I were headed. Well, where isn't there weather? I whined, looking up at the board. Can't they be more specific? Amy's flight to New York had been affected by distant storms as well. It was one of those times when your flights are delayed and then delayed again. The D.C. departure time moved from 7 to 8, then eventually to 9:45. Amy's flight was canceled altogether, so she wound up catching a taxi and spending the night in a hotel. After sitting around for a while, Hugh and I decided we might as well eat dinner. There weren't many choices at that hour, so we went to the 42nd Street Oyster Bar. This is where my mom and dad were the night Martin Luther King was assassinated, I said to Hugh after we had ordered. Not here at the airport, obviously, but at their original location downtown. I told him how someone had stepped out of the kitchen to announce the news and how everyone but my parents had applauded. Our family hadn't been in the South very long, and that was a real eye-opener. Hmm, Hugh said, pulling out his phone. I'm just going to text Amy and see if she was able to book a flight for tomorrow morning. I looked around at our fellow diners, all on their way to somewhere else, but all I could think about was my father crawling through his house in search of a chair he could use to hoist himself up. He'd said it so matter-of-factly, what I do, as if I'd asked how he makes a sandwich. There are any number of people who have to live like that when they get to be terribly old, but for him, it's a choice. My father could have a nice place. There could be help at the ready should he fall, a cook, a driver, someone to make the bed every morning. He's just too cheap to pay for it. The killer, I said to Hugh, who had finished texting Amy and was now texting someone else, is that he's saving the money to give to his kids, who will spend it wildly, without even thinking. Maybe not Lisa, but you've seen everyone else in action. A person could live handsomely on the money we waste over the course of a given year, and here's our father wandering from room to room with a flashlight? He falls and gets banged up, then covers his bruises with cotton balls and masking tape because Band-Aids are too expensive? Why don't you pay to get him a driver, he asked. Because he can afford it on his own, I told him. Of course, he was right. I should at least offer to pay. Like anyone else, my father loves free stuff. I was hesitating in part because he'd cut me out of his will. You told me you wanted to be cut out, he'd said 5 years earlier when I confronted him about it. When? I asked. I don't know, but you did. There was no way on earth that this was true. In that respect, my father is very much like the current president. There were 1.5 million people at my inauguration, the biggest crowd ever, 1.5 million. It's hard to even call it lying. Rather, it's a form of insistence. This is the way I need it to be, goddammit. He then told me I could pick something out of the house, and he'd set it aside for me to inherit. I looked around at the furniture, all of it covered with papers, and at the gloomy artwork he and my mother had bought in the 70s. There's a guide for mixing drinks you have downstairs behind the bar, I said. A bawdy paperback from 1960, illustrated by a cartoonist named Vip. I wouldn't mind having that, I suppose. But you don't even drink, he said. I sighed. You know what? You're right. It's better you give it to Amy or Paul. One of them might want a pink squirrel some night. Our food was delivered, and I said to Hugh, I don't remember ever fighting with my mom, but with me and my dad it was constant. Once in high school he was shouting at me for something or other, running too much bathwater maybe, and I shouted back, You are going to die alone. Isn't that awful? I pushed some shrimp and grits around my plate. Now here he is, trying to do just that, die alone. And everyone's giving him a hard time about it. When our check came, I paid. He went to our gate, but there was still an hour to kill before boarding, so I took a walk from one end of the terminal to the other, then back again, passing the now shuttered Brooks Brothers, the Starbucks, the bookstore. This terminal didn't exist when I lived in Chicago or New York. The Raleigh airport was smaller and slower back then. I'd fly home for a visit and wait at the baggage claim for 30 minutes before calling the house. My father would answer, a bad sign, as it was he who was supposed to pick me up. Did you forget I was flying in? I'd ask. I told you my plane was landing at 6. Well, it's not 6 o'clock yet. Dad, it's 6:30. No, it's not. I'm looking at the clock in the airport and at my watch, and both say 6:30. Well, it's sure as hell not 6:30 here, but I'm on my way. I'm leaving the house right now. 20 minutes later, I'd phone again, and again he would pick up. I could hear his TV in the background. I told you I'm on my way, Jesus! I'd wish then that I could afford to go to the ticket counter and buy a seat on the next plane back to where I'd come from. My father would arrive to pick me up, and I'd be gone, a speck in the sky. The secret to Dad's longevity isn't diet or exercise or even his genes, I've often said to Paul and my sisters. He's just late for death, the way he's been late for everything else all his life. There are things I avoid talking about with my father now, politics, for instance. He's always operated on the assumption that I don't know anything, can't know anything, really. The issues are as far beyond my grasp as they are for the chimps in the calendar he gave me. Sure, one might pull a lever in a voting booth, but there could be no actual thought behind it. The fight we had following Trump's election had been particularly ugly, and we could easily have it again every hour of every day. I don't want to, though. Don't want what could be the last words we say to each other to be ugly. It's why I didn't bring up Jim Comey during our visit. Easier to put on a straw hat that once belonged to my mother, and to accept with grace the framed postcards and nature calendars I dropped into an airport trash can before boarding my flight to Washington. It wasn't where they belonged, necessarily. It was just where they ended up.
This has been a Hachette audio production of Calypso, written by David Sedaris and read by the author. Executive producer, Michelle McGonigal. Produced and directed by Maya Thomas. With original music composed and performed by Daniel Hart. Recorded by Patrick Fitzgerald at Polarity Post. Edited by John Colucci. Mixed and mastered by Tommy Herron. Live recordings of Little Guy, Your English Is So Good, and While You're Up There, Check on My Prostate, courtesy of Hamer Hall Arts Centre, Melbourne, Australia. Live recording of I'm Still Standing, courtesy of Popejoy Hall, University of New Mexico, Chris Pacheco, audio engineer. Calypso is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018 by David Sedaris. Audio production copyright 2018 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.